Welcome to the Scientist Podcast, the show for anyone wanting to understand the realities of research life. We bring you into the lives of top academics so that you can get to know the people behind the research that's shaping our world. I'm Jamie, your host, and in this podcast, I'll be bringing you candid conversations each week with those on the cutting edge of their fields. And we're live. Hey everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Scientist Podcast. This week, we're doing something slightly different. We've got two of our very own on the podcast, so you can get to know them a little bit better. Today, I'm lucky enough to be able to introduce Jennifer Musa and Daniela Lazaro. Jennifer's about to start her PhD in Copenhagen and has recently been working on the contamination of water sources in Lebanon by antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which is something we'll definitely get into because I've got less than a working knowledge of antibiotic resistance, but it's one of those fascinating slash slightly terrifying concepts that are attractive in a really perverse kind of way. And then we've got Daniela. Daniela has her PhD under her belt already. She studied biomaterials and breast cancer characterization and is currently working as a postdoc at Exeter on spine degeneration. So there's a huge amount to get into today. But before any of that, Jennifer, Daniela, welcome to the pods. How's it going?
Hello. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us, Jamie. It's going well. Enjoying a nice weather in the UK.
You guys are dialing in from a couple of quite different places. We've got Daniela in Exeter. And Jennifer, where are you in the world?
I'm in Lebanon now.
How's it going?
It's going good. Protests and different things, but it's going good. Hoping to leave soon.
Just very briefly, I'd love for you to tell our listeners a little bit about what's going on economically and why there are protests in Lebanon.
There's a major economic issue. We have the equivalent of our currency to the United States dollars. It was 1,500 Lebanese pounds. It's now at 10,000 Lebanese pounds. So everything is too expensive while the paychecks are still the same. So people are protesting because they cannot buy main things like food, drinks, anything. They cannot buy these.
Over what period of time has it gone up by that much?
A year.
Seriously. So the thing, it's gone up yes. Six times in a year. That's hyperinflation territory.
Yes, exactly. We're the third worst currency in the world now.
The third worst currency in the world.
Yes.
It's not something we're going to spend much longer talking about, but I sort of just wanted to nod at the fact that there's real economic upheaval in Lebanon. I have to start with you, Jennifer. I need to ask straight away, what were you up to in Lebanon with the antibiotic resistance?
So first, I thought before starting my master's, the topic was interesting because some people were reporting that we have some resistance to normal antibiotics that people usually used to use. And some people talked about it. But until I started actually working with it, that I found that it's a major problem because the water that I'm working on is the water that goes into the households in Lebanon that people drink. And I'm going to start with the main issue and the main finding of my project was I found a carbapenem resistant determinant, a gene that codes for carbapenem resistance, which is an antibiotic that is of last resort when we have an infection. And when people are infected with carbapenem resistant isolates, they have like very limited number of antibiotics that they can use. And having people drinking this is a major problem, very big problem. In addition to having like around, I found out of 90 isolates, 25 of them that are multi-drug resistant, that are resistant to a large spectrum of antibiotics. And these are going into our households.
And is that because the water isn't treated? I mean, I'm sitting here in the UK thinking that sounds terrifying. Is that something that we could run into?
The water in Lebanon is not treated. That's the first problem. The infrastructure in Lebanon has suffered a lot since 1975, the war in Lebanon, and it was not fixed. In addition, we have sewage going into our water systems, which is also a big problem. And we have poultry, we have the contamination from the environment, all of these things, and the overuse of antibiotics and having the hospital effluent sewage going into the water in Lebanon, into the drinking water, and being mixed with that. So it is leading to more and more resistance. In addition, we have one of the key points of my project is the horizontal gene transfer and the transfer of resistance from hospital bacteria to the bacteria that are usually present in the water that are usually not harmful to us. And this is a thing that is happening. We have the transfer of resistance from hospital effluents and from sewage from households into our drinking water.
I mean, it's terrible. It's so interesting. Sitting as a Westerner, I think of Lebanon as one of the more liberal economically developed states in the Middle East, a country that takes on a huge number of refugees every year, a country that, you know, in terms of their research, et cetera, is more first world than third world. So it's so interesting to chat to someone sitting in Beirut who's explaining that actually the sewage systems from the hospitals are linked up to the drinking water. And by the way, the drinking water is untreated. Is that something that's a priority for the government? Is it the idea that...
No, it's not. We don't have priorities in our government, sadly. Their priorities is directed to finding first the government. We don't have actually now a government in Lebanon. So like I said before, since 1975, we have not developed our infrastructure. We don't have electricity regularly. And it's sad to talk about it. We have good education systems. We have a good environment. We have fascinating nature. But like the things that we focus on are not the things that are important, like the health of the people that live here.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a major scale infrastructure type project that's required. But it's very difficult to undertake one of those when you're suffering hyperinflation. It's reminiscent of, it's so interesting, when we were talking just a little bit before we started recording about the economic crisis, I couldn't help but think about Weimar Germany. You know, Germany in the 1920s, they had hyperinflation and the exact type of things you were talking about, and as far as food becoming very difficult to get hold of, wages staying the same is hugely difficult. I have to ask, in terms of the research itself, were you doing that in Beirut with the university?
I was doing it in the Lebanese American University in Byblos, which is also linked to the Lebanese American University in Beirut. And we were lucky enough to have funding. We had the university throwing a lot of money into research. And that's why I had enough resources. I had enough material to do all of my research. I had one of the biggest projects in my lab. And it's a good thing, but we had the problem of ordering everything from Europe or from the US. So everything was late to arrive. We had organization in the lab. We had a great team of people who get a hold of everything. So it was a smooth experience. I spent 3 years on the project and now it's in peer review for it to get accepted.
I mean, that's very exciting. At the risk of this being a slightly silly question, when you're looking for antibiotic resistance and you're looking for bacteria, are you taking samples from the water itself? Are you going in sort of arm up and taking water and then putting it in the lab? What's the process?
I wasn't going myself. We had a team who went to the different places. We were taking water from rivers, the actual water, and then we dilute it. Because if we take the sample by itself, we have a huge number of bacteria that we cannot isolate. We dilute it a bit, and then we take isolated colonies. We look at them and we look at the resistance profiles to different antibiotics. And by the way, you mentioned like Lebanon takes a big number of refugees. One of the also key parts of my project is that we were looking at comparing part of the refugee camps to the rivers and if they are affecting, because there's also no sewage treatment there and the effluent of the sewage is going directly into the water there. And we were looking at the differences and we found this resistance gene, the carbapenem resistance gene there. And yes, we take the water samples, we look at them and we look at the resistance profile. And after looking at the resistance profile, we compare them to other studies and people who have been doing that. And to note something, the resistance percentage has increased a lot in Lebanon between 1995 then to 2017 to 2020. When I finished my study, we have a very high increase in number in resistance from water sources.
And why the increase in resistance?
Because of the sewage effluent into the water.
And that's something that presumably is going to keep on getting worse until the sewage is addressed.
Yes, exactly. Which is not going to happen soon because like we're mainly focusing now on giving people food.
Really, it does become about priorities. And as shocking and sobering it is to say, having clean water probably isn't a priority in the context of people starving because of hyperinflation. So moving on to next year, you're going to be in Copenhagen.
Yes.
What are you up to?
I was supposed to start in May, but because of COVID, it's delayed. Yesterday, I found it's delayed till August. I will be also working on horizontal gene transfer. And now I'm going to be moving into more specific area. That's why I'm very excited about it. I'm going to be looking at the mechanisms that are involved in the horizontal gene transfer of plasmids from one bacterium to the other and trying to find a solution for this, because this is also a big problem. Bacteria have the plasmids that have the genes that code for resistance. And they can be transferred from one bacterium to the other rather easily, and especially when under stress, because the bacterium is trying to survive and it's trying to send its parts to different places. So it is a major and a big problem. So a part of my thesis will be finding a solution to this, either to stop it or to decrease it.
I mean, that's unbelievably meaningful work, trying to kind of use the sort of experience in Copenhagen and the PhD to try and address the antibiotic resistance in Lebanon. I mean, is the academic community, at least the scientific academic community, rallying around this as an issue? Because this is clearly an issue that has an infrastructure solution, but that also has a scientific solution.
A big part of research, and especially in bacteriology, is going towards finding the solution to antibiotic resistance, because we're reaching a point where no antibiotics are working. The last resort now is colistin, which has toxic effects on the human body. So the scientific community is moving a lot towards, also they're trying to find solution from natural products, from looking at the mechanisms that are involved in the resistance and targeting these. So we have a lot of scientific papers that are targeted towards this.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's totally fascinating and incredibly sobering.
This podcast episode is sponsored by BioBox Analytics. BioBox is a data analytics platform designed for scientists and clinicians working with next-generation sequencing data. With BioBox, you can design and run bioinformatic pipelines on demand, generate publication-ready plots, and discover insights using popular public databases. Spots are limited, so sign up for the waitlist and be the first to access a free account at biobox.io.
Daniela, I want to bring you in here. You're sitting in Exeter at the minute, but you have been in Sheffield for a number of years, which I note is pretty far from Mexico in more ways than one. I'm just interested in the transition from being in Mexico to being in Sheffield.
It was definitely a quite difficult experience, difficult and nice, because you learn a lot of good things while you're moving from your original country to a different place, especially when you're comparing Latin America to Europe. So it was difficult. It was scary, but I'm really happy I did it. I moved to Sheffield in 2014 for my master's. I think probably I was more scared about the transition and getting everything sorted out, because I moved to the UK with a scholarship. So I think every international student can easily tell you all the stress associated with securing funding for studies and also to moving to a different country, because it is associated as well with a lot of stress of getting visas done, living arrangements when you cannot visit places. And also going to a completely different system. The UK education system is so different to Mexico's. So it was about relearning how a school works and how university systems and managing across different platforms. So it was quite nice, but challenging at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's done a master's degree, especially a master's degree in science, will tell you that it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. Because presumably you're leaving home, you're moving somewhere different, it's difficult academically, you're making friends, it's a new city. Now chuck on top of that, new country, new culture, new food, new language, new weather. I mean, Sheffield's a gorgeous city, but it's pretty industrial. And the architecture, it's called the Steel City. I imagine it is quite a shock when you're just walking around.
It is, but at the same time, it is not. The reason why it is not is because Sheffield, or the university, the area, has been shaped towards a university town rather than an industrial city. And everything is quite contained around the city center and around the university buildings. But once you move to the real city and, well, like residential areas, you can see that disparity on how different it looks. And also, I noticed it was quite clear that you can see from where people with regular jobs live and people with the higher pay grades are established as well. So it was quite shocking to see those differences, because you move here with a lot of preconceptions of how Europe works, especially coming from a third world country. And that was something that I wasn't expected to see in the UK.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing. My dad is South African and he came here in the 70s and spoke about how he was expecting the UK to be racially equal. He thought, I mean, South Africa at the time was under an apartheid government, but the UK, that's where equality lived. And he got here and it wasn't like that at all. And it was a total culture shock coming from, like, Mexico, somewhere between a third and a first world country in South Africa. When you were in Sheffield, you were doing a couple of things, but one of them was breast cancer characterization. For non-scientists, what is breast cancer characterization?
So for characterization is a term that is used generally in biomaterials or any type of materials. It is to determine the properties of the material. This can be physical or chemical. And in this case, when I was studying breast cancer, I was using a vibrational spectroscopy technique, which basically we apply some energy, we let the molecules vibrate, and depending on how they vibrate, we establish the quantity of proteins, carbohydrates, or other biomolecules on the tissue. But it has been found that cancer tissue has different vibrations in comparison with healthy tissue. And these small differences at biomolecule level, let's say higher quantity of proteins, different degradation of carbohydrates, can give you an indication if the cancer is present, how advanced it is, and it can also help you grade and classify, which can accelerate a lot of diagnosis later on.
Okay, that was going to be my question. With that information, presumably you can pick up whether cancerous cells are present before it's visible that cancer cells are present to the human eye.
Yeah, in terms of breast cancer specifically, you will have precancerous changes at biomolecular level, especially in the microenvironment. So the tissue will start preparing to change and to start transforming into a cancerous environment. And also you can pick up these before you even start generating tumors that I will contain and that later on will lead to invasion or invasive cases.
Oh, interesting. You can pick it up pre-tumor emerging, which means if you know you have a high propensity for risk for breast cancer and you're getting checked regularly with this kind of technology, this is something that could pick it up just after the point at which the cancer is formed.
Yes. And it could be really useful, especially if we're talking about breast cancer. There is well established that some carriers for certain genes are more propensed. They have a lot more chances to suffer from breast cancer. But I need to mention that these specific techniques, that is Raman spectroscopy and FTIR, they're at the moment quite subjected to only be used on tissue sections. Because in case of Raman, you are using quite high energy lasers. And in case of FTIR, they only work with dry samples. However, there are developments on more specialized technology to bring this to the clinic. And right now they are, not a lot, but there are different companies, especially here in the UK, that are focusing on using these technologies to analyze cancers in brain cancer and I think other types of cancers that are already in clinical trials.
I mean, it's totally fascinating stuff. At the minute, you're doing something slightly different, although equally fascinating, dare I say, which is spine degeneration. I'm fascinated by this. What is spine degeneration? And does it tie into your PhD and as far as your PhD was about biomaterials?
Yes, it wasn't my PhD, it was more my master's project. I was working on developing a biomaterial for bone regeneration. In that case, I was working on scaffolds that were freeze-dried with plastics or polymers, and that also included bioactive materials. In that case, for bone regeneration, we were using hydroxyapatite. And in order to offer a little bit more of mechanical strength for low bearing applications, I was using graphene nanosheets. And then I moved to the characterization be the breast cancer. So it was quite a big change, but using similar techniques that we were using for the biomaterials. And now that, as you mentioned, I'm working on spine degeneration. So it is quite a different topic, but all of these can be applied. All the skills that you gain to your master PhD will be of a great use in different projects towards your academic career. Now that I'm working as a postdoc, I'm working on spine degeneration. I'm using these skills to develop a bioreactor, which will allow us to test explants or pieces of intervertebral disc that we can get from animals or from humans and to apply different loads in order to kind of replicate movements from regular everyday movements that we carry on.
Yeah, so is the idea here that the spine is degenerating on the molecular level? Because when I hear spine degeneration, my first thought is, well, when you get old, your bones deteriorate. But I get the sense that that's not exactly what we're talking about here.
It's not necessarily associated with aging, although definitely it's presented during aging. It's part of the process. If we are subjected to different loads, probably we are not loading things in the right way. Of course, it can cause damage to the disc. But this also has a lot to do with genetics, and there are a lot of comorbidities that can also influence the early degeneration of the intervertebral disc. A lot of young people present this, and also it affects people in their working age. So you can have it as young as if you are 40 years old. And the thing is, you can have degeneration, but it will not automatically be reflected into lower back pain. But I think everyone, at least once in their lives, have suffered from this. And this can be a sign of probably the disc is not as healthy as you think.
Yeah, and spine degeneration strikes me as one of those areas where developments in nanotechnologies, etc., are eventually going to mean that people have more mobility, less pain, etc. I mean, I was reading recently about cases where people who were previously paralyzed, which is typically a spinal issue, they were typically paralyzed and they've been able to regain significant movement because of development in nanotechnologies. When you're looking at something like spine degeneration, Is that the kind of space you're wanting to head in?
The purpose of the research is more about extending or giving the opportunity to people who are presenting chronic lower back pain, regaining that mobility and be able to help them improve their quality of life rather than delay the effects of aging. However, if we can better understand how the spine degenerates and how the cells respond to different activities or different morbidities or different lifestyles, that could also help us to advise in terms of what can be done and why it should be avoided.
Very interesting. I hear that. Guys, I want to turn the conversation a little bit towards the last year and then sort of for 2021 to come. I mean, the elephant in the room whenever you talk to researchers is the fact that everyone's been doing lab work from home, which is easier said than done. They've been separated from their colleagues and they've had a generally quite difficult time in academia. And I sort of want to ask very openly, how has it been for you? Jennifer, I want to start with you. You're obviously in Lebanon at the minute. How has lockdown been for you, both personally and from the perspective of your research and your work?
We had two lockdowns in Lebanon, and it was quite different, the two lockdowns. The first one was at the stage of writing my manuscript. So I was taking the time to actually write, to finalize everything, and I was being productive. But the second lockdown was hectic. I finished my writing and my manuscript was sent already, and I had some lab work to do. And being separated from the lab for this long, I've been working in the lab for 40 years constantly. I used to go on weekends because I had another job. So now being at home for 2 months without being able to go to the lab was strange to me. I miss going there. I miss everything there, but I know that it's dangerous. So I can't wait to go back and to start my PhD and then actually go back to working every day in the lab.
I mean, that's the thing. Lebanon had two fairly heavy lockdowns. And now if you're thinking about moving forward, starting a PhD in the context of a new year, new city, that's an exciting place to be.
Yes, exactly.
And Daniela, you've been in Exeter. Did you get a chance to go home to Mexico over Christmas? Or have you been sort of locked down in the strictest sense?
I stay in the UK for Christmas. I think this might be my second year because last year as well, I was trying to secure a position. I decided to stay and I regretted it a little bit because it has been a long time. But in terms of leading with COVID restrictions and lockdown, it is quite difficult, especially because I started my position in March, just right before the first lockdown. So moving to a new city and they stay at home without being able to work and without being able to even learn what the city has to offer, it is a little bit challenging. But I think everyone's in the same boat here.
Well, that's the thing. If you were locked down but had full access to your work, you could rationalize it. You could say, well, look, the city will be there when everything opens up, but at least I can chuck myself into my work. And when you can't, I mean, I guess that's when you're especially tempted or especially missing the opportunity to wander around a new city. Because anyone who's ever moved city knows that that's the fun. That's the fun. I mean, it's such a different place to Sheffield too, Exeter. It's a village, right, comparatively.
Yeah, it is a smaller, I will also say it's a little bit less diverse, which also kind of shocked me at the time. Because once again, you have these preconceptions and Sheffield is quite a large city in comparison with Exeter. And as my representation of the UK, that was something that I really miss, just being around a more diverse community.
But now things are opening up. I'm interested in how it's going to change for you. Are you going to have more of a chance to kind of get into the work?
Yes, I had the opportunity to go back to the lab in September, which has been great as well, because having hands-on, especially when you're starting a new project, and especially when you change the area of research that you were doing, it is very, very nice. I had the opportunity because I needed to develop some things for the bioreactor that I could do at home. So I actually got some work done during lockdowns, several that we have right now. And I think all universities have implemented COVID-safe regulations, so it is easier to go back to the lab and also you will feel safer just working there.
I think that's quite an optimistic note to leave this on. With Jennifer moving to Copenhagen doing a PhD and things opening up and you're back in the lab. Before we head, I want to give you guys the chance to just sort of share with everyone where everyone can get you online. So Jennifer, starting with you, if everyone wants to follow what you're up to, where can they find you?
So usually I use Twitter a lot. I share a lot about my research and the struggles I go through when writing and in the lab and about my kitten recently. And my Twitter account is Musa Jenny, and they can follow me there. And my scientist account of course, Jennifer Musa. And this is mainly where I share my thoughts a lot.
Brilliant, Jennifer. And Daniela, where can everyone find you?
You can find me on Twitter. My handle is @dinosaurlp. And you can just find me there as Dr. Daniela Lazzaro. And just kind of ride the wave after the remarks for Dr. Biden.
Brilliant. Well, Jennifer, Daniela, thank you for joining me. And everyone at home, thank you for listening. I hope you've sort of got to know us a little bit better than you did before. Jennifer and Daniela are up to some seriously cool stuff. I'm sure you agree. And it's been great to have an opportunity to chat with you guys. So thanks so much for listening. And as always, we'll see you next week.